there's a lot of hating going on. You pop a cherry with an orgy and it's all good.
Really, really talented, handsome young man.
Don't walk in here with a giant banana and think everything's going to be peaches.
Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Monday, April 4th, 2011. I'm your host, Adam Barry. Joining me today, three April Fools. We got Greg Luca.
Hey, man.
Kyle Maestri from InsideTheGators.com.
Yeah, new change. Right? We'll get to that later, but thanks, Adam, for having me.
And Jesse Simonson.
How's it going?
We have got some stuff to talk about today. It's basketball season's over. We are essentially relegated to talking about National College Basketball, the NCAA Tournament, the Final Four. And, of course, everyone's favorite topic in this room, Florida spring football. The orange and blue game is this Saturday. I can barely contain my excitement right now, nearly jumping out of my chair. So we're going to look forward to that a little bit, talk some Gator baseball because we got Jesse here. And people asked for some more small sports stuff. But let's start it off with the most exciting topic in the room, Florida spring football. What's going on, Kyle? You're the senior writer for covering Florida football. What's happening?
You got to give me some more specific direction than that, man. There's too much happening.
How about that O-line?
Possibly answer that question.
How's that O-line working?
The O-line. I actually wrote a story recently about the O-line, so it's right in my wheelhouse.
There you go.
The O-line is decimated by injuries, but I actually wrote a column recently saying that it doesn't matter. Because if anything, I think it might actually help them down the road just because guys who they were relying on as, like, starters before practice, like the Matt Patchins, James Wilson, and Xavier Nixon trio in particular, are guys who are older and, like, have more experience in theory, but they're extremely injury-prone, not just in this spring practice, but throughout their career. And also, they're guys who have struggled at times when they've been in the game.
Right.
So if those are three guys you're counting on, and you don't take the spring to necessarily develop depth around them, then you might be screwed if one of them gets hurt and or is bad come fall. So this way, you know you're getting all your young guys as much development as in the spring as you possibly can. Like, all these guys who normally wouldn't get first-team reps or who wouldn't be, you know, taking as many reps as they are right now, the Jonathan Harrisons and the Ian Silbermans and the Chaz Greens of the world, these guys are going to be ready to go come fall where they might not have otherwise. And I think that's a good thing because they were going to be thin no matter what. That's one of the things Will Muschamp said. So now, in my opinion, you really got these young guys some experience. And if a guy misses 4 to 6 weeks in the spring, like I say, 4 to 6 weeks of what? What is he missing exactly? So they have plenty of time to heal up, and I think this won't be as big of a deal.
Now, of the guys who got hurt, how many of them were, like, projected starters? Is there kind of a projected O-line?
Or got hurt during spring practice or beforehand?
Or missed some part of spring practice for
okay.
whatever reason.
Patchin. I mean, I'd say Patchin, Wilson, and then Nixon just had, like, a sprained ankle. He just missed a few practices,
right.
So he's not that injured. He was also very underweight, but that's a different discussion. But I'd say the three of them were definitely projected as starters. Jalapio would have been a fourth. That fifth spot would have been kind of up for grabs. I don't really know who would have grabbed that fifth spot, but now you're looking at potentially, like, maybe some of these older guys getting beat out. Like, if
right.
James Wilson isn't productive, maybe somebody else takes his job. So
that's what I'm saying is, like, how much do we know about, like, a Xavier, like, especially if he's underweight? Like, is Xavier Nixon with no or with limited spring experience really better than a Ian Silverman or whoever's going to be playing out or whoever's actually practicing at tackle right now?
Chaz Green's a tackle. And Nixon's been at the other tackle, at right tackle. I don't know who's been there while he's been out. But no, I don't know. Not necessarily. I mean, Nixon's a guy who had a good freshman year. People had high expectations for him. He got hurt, as we're talking about, heading into his sophomore year, missed a lot of camp and stuff. Came back, was not the same player at all. Didn't look good out there. Got some playing time taken away from him. People expected him to contribute a lot last year, and he didn't play. On the offensive line, you had Jalapio play and Maurice hurt, and you didn't really see any Nixon. So this year he comes back, and the coaches put them through a rigorous off-season training program with a lot of running where they wanted to get them all in good shape first and foremost. And Nixon was down under, like, 260, which is way too small to be playing offensive line in the SEC. So, I mean, he can put the weight back on, and he can put good weight on. There's a lot of time left in between now. There's 5 months in between now and the start of the season. But, I mean, there's a lot of question marks around him. And that's what I was kind of getting at with the column is these guys who, like, you know, everybody's kind of freaking out about. A lot of question marks around a lot of them. So the more depth you have developed, the better.
Right, and that's kind of the point of spring is to you know, is to get everybody on the same page, more or less, you know, because like in the fall you can perfect your starters, you can make them game ready, but at this point it's like you want to have depth heading into fall practice if God forbid somebody else gets seriously hurt.
Yeah, I think the only thing you're really worried about is just not, it's specifically for a position like offensive line, is developing some sort of continuity between five guys,
right?
And like that, getting five guys together, because it's a big deal when five, you know, Nixon may not work, you know, the same next to one guy or the other, you know, and so that's the only issue that you worry about. Building depth is obviously a plus for the team, but five guys playing together, it's a big deal. Mr. Phenomenal might have a different experience running behind, you know, X versus running behind Y, so.
I actually agree with that a lot, but I'm kind of like, I don't know, I'm sort of taking a radical point of view at this point, but I say let the young guys play. Like, unless Patchett and Nixon, like, return to, like, you know, somehow become these players that they've always supposed to have been throughout their career but never have been here.
Right.
Like, these guys who are getting first-team reps, they've talked about it in interviews. They were all together getting second-team reps. They came in together. They're all friends. They're all tight. If they're doing a good job out there, let them play. You know, if that's your best unit, let them play together. Maybe you bring in one or two of the veteran guys. But, I mean, if you have, like, you're going to build your core around, like, Jonathan Harrison, Jalapio, and Chaz Green, and then kind of fill in the blanks after that, like, let them play together. I don't know. Maybe it's a good thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing.
Right. Chemistry certainly something you want to keep an eye on in there. But you mentioned Mr. Phenomenal, Chris Rainey.
Yeah, having a hell of a spring.
Yeah, he's having a phenomenal spring has been the buzzword. He's the only scholarship running back able to take snaps right now, right? Because
yes.
You've got Jeff Nemp's running track. Gillislee's got a fractured foot.
Stress fracture in his foot.
Yeah. Mack Brown had shoulder surgery. Mike Blakely had shoulder surgery.
Mack Brown's meniscus, something or other.
Yeah.
Somebody had a fibula.
That's Gillislee.
Gillislee has the egg.
He's got a fibula.
He's got a fibula.
Right, okay.
Not a word. But
I got a fibula. You got a fibula. We all got a fibula.
Right. Did not have a procedure as somebody else did,
right.
But he did have a fibula.
Maybe he'll be healthy too.
Right. So right now it's just Rainey, and like Trey Burton is taking third down snaps. Muschamp said they've got nobody else, but Rainey apparently bouncing back after a pretty rough. He's certainly not eager to talk about how he's doing it. His recent media opportunity, but he said it's a lot more like high school. He's a lot more comfortable running out of the eye. It's helping his vision. He can see a lot more what's happening. What do you see for him, and what do you see out of the backfield?
I see nothing. It's kind of the point of this whole spring thing is we don't get to see anything. So this is a lot of a Brantley situation to me, Brantley pre-last year, where it's like if Rainey comes out like isn't good during the season or isn't that good during the season, this is the team's fault. It's not the media's fault because – the team just comes out and like just says how awesome Chris Rainey is like every day. Pretty much everyone on the team. So we're not the ones hyping him. The team is hyping him just like Brantley got hyped as like, you know, the greatest, best quarterback in the SEC before he even took a snap.
Right.
So we'll see what happens with Rainey. But I will say this, with Brantley this year, I know this is off the Rainey subject, but if Brantley comes out and he's bad again this year, blame the media for that.
Right.
Because there's a lot of people fishing for, you know, Brantley's turned it all around stories. And if you listen to the quotes, and I wrote this for something we did on the site the other day, if you listen to what players are saying about him, they're not throwing him under the bus, but they're not saying John Brantley's going to be awesome and, like, we're really excited. Yeah. He's totally different in their offense. It's kind of like, Brantley, you know, not much of a difference, that kind of
just
stuff.
Brantley.
Go listen to that Frankie Hammond interview. That one told the whole story.
Exactly.
It was pretty much like, I don't really see much difference between this year and last year.
Right.
We'll just see if it's all about making reads
right.
And this, that, and it was
routes
it was
is routes,
funny.
Man.
Right. Yeah. Seriously, with the way they hype up everybody's performance and they blow everything way out of proportions, if they're not saying excellent things about John Brantley, you can kind of use the conversion to say
right.
That he's really not doing that good.
Right.
And it's funny, but then other people, none of us that are here, but other people have been fishing for the Driscoll stuff, you know, because they've teased it, coaches and players have teased it, that he's made these, you know, gigantic leaps from when he was struggling at the very, you know, the first couple practices to where he is now. So that hype will only continue to expand before the season starts and after the first couple of interceptions Brantley throws.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because people aren't just fishing for, like, John Brantley is the perfect fit for this pro-style offense thing. They're also searching for, like, John Brantley has turned into the quintessential leader of the Gators offense. Like, it's really getting out of proportion. I would agree if the Brantley train runs off the track once again, that is kind of the media's fault. Let's talk about, you mentioned Frankie
Hammond. But the thing they have been saying about Brantley, I did write a story about this, is just that he's been a little bit more vocal and a little bit more of a leader. So I know there are a lot of people writing stuff like that, but we have been getting those kind of quotes from them about him with the quarterbacks and working hard on and off the field. Muschamp's been given a lot of quotes like that. There just hasn't been a whole lot of, like, players saying, like, this is a new John Brantley. You guys better watch out.
Right.
So.
It's kind of like same old John Brantley, different system. We're just going to see if it works out
exactly.
for the best. So,
yeah.
Let's talk about some of the receivers. You mentioned Frankie Hammond. Kind of a weird mix. Deontay, I don't even know if we talked about the Deontay Thompson situation from a couple weeks ago. He's looking at, like, a third receiver role at this point.
He doesn't seem to admit it, but it sounds like he's definitely, like, third on the depth chart.
It's a misprint.
It's just, this is what I hate, you know? I mean,
we can't
really get to the bottom of any of this stuff. And then if we do, how much does it really matter? But, yeah, I mean, right now, it's been Hines and Hammond mentioned first, and Deontay is like, oh, crap, I better not forget him because I don't want a media firestorm.
Right.
Like, that's what the impression I've been getting from a lot of people. And Quentin Dunbar, supposedly, is the best receiver in Florida history. So, you know, hopefully he can get on the field if he's that good. But, yeah,
Solomon
I mean,
Patton said the swag is back.
The swag is back, apparently, to Florida and the receivers.
We've seen 3 years of Deontay Thompson at this point. Everybody... Is anyone surprised by this, really? If this is a good thing for Florida football, if anything.
It's like, you know what you're getting out of Deontay Thompson, and if other people are at least being talked about as being better than him, then you're in good shape because he won't see as much time. Quentin Dunbar, this year's Sam Roby?
I think Quentin Dunbar might actually be good because there was a lot of hype on him last year, although he never saw the field. Urban Meyer wouldn't dare give him a snap, but he loved him and thought he was great. And
great kid.
There's this quote I keep running in all my Quentin Dunbar stories now from Carl Johnson that he gave to the Palm Beach Post while he was doing like a workout, and it was just like what young players impress you, and it was something about how like Quentin Dunbar is awesome and he should have played, but I'm not a coach, but you know he's so dynamic and stuff.
Oh, wow.
So like that kind of stuff I sort of like read into. Players have definitely been wrong before. Will Hill is supposedly the best player in camp a couple years ago. But, you know, a quote like that to me says a lot about the kind of respect he has from other people. So if they don't find a way to use him this year, at least see what he's got, I think that'd be a mistake.
Right. And, I mean, the other guys were looking at Stephen Ali came out and spoke to the media. I think he's got to be used at some point. He's somebody I think that I'm going to be keeping an eye on in the spring game. Just because he's so tall, he's so big, they should be using a guy like him. Who else is even on that receiver's depth chart at this point?
You got, like, Solomon Patton, Robert Clark, a couple of little guys who can maybe play in the slot, catch some screens for you.
Bobby Clark is what much.
Bobby Clark.
It's outrageous.
Jeez. How's that? DeBose.
Oh, yeah.
Who's sort of disappointing still to this point. Supposedly he's kind of been hampered by a sprained ankle as well. But not a whole lot of positive DeBose talk this spring, which I don't know how long you can wait on this kid. This guy's a super recruit, so... He's got to prove some stuff to a lot of people soon.
Those were some of the biggest quotes that I've taken from this whole spring was like what Muschamp said when he went on his whole rant about, you know, I'm not talking about potential and, you know, you know, you got to do it on the field. And he then talked about just how much athletic ability and potential, you know, that DeBose has. But they're just waiting to see it and waiting for him to be a consistent player that, you know, one day he shows it and the next day he's loafing.
All right. Yeah. All right, so Jordan Reed is back at tight end and happy as ever to be there from that to me was such a depressing moment in my journalistic career was going out and talking to Jordan Reed about his change back to tight end because that was a story that everybody wanted. He was quarterback last year. Everybody liked him there because he was good. You know, everybody was Cam Newton 2.0, whatever. The terrible comparisons were, but now he's back at tight end, and he doesn't seem to be too excited about it. I don't know, you guys were there. What did you think of that? Nothing at all.
Yeah, I don't really know. I don't have anything to say about Jordan Reed. But we'll see if he's really that good or not. He's getting a lot of hype right now. I've heard some talk of him, you know, being, you know, the next great tight end at Florida, but, I mean, I don't know. We can't see anything.
Right. People saying I just heard some CI comparison.
Okay,
so we shall see.
Here's the most disappointing part of the Jordan Reed thing, though. Remember when apparently Ed Ashoff, now at ESPN, asked him his first media availability?
Yes.
You're going to do some Wildcat snaps, Jordan? He's like, yeah.
They asked him if he was doing Wildcat snaps, and he said, yeah, I was taking some. And then I asked him, like this last week, if he'd been doing any Wildcat snaps, and he said no. So, I don't know. I, again, we can't see it, so I can't tell you what is or what isn't, really. But Yeah. That's funny. Reports.
Because Joe Gervin asked Muschamp what if they were even bringing back the Wildcat, and Muschamp was like, "Got to pay a ticket to check that one out."
Right. Yeah, that was the get a seat. Like, yeah,
that was a giant stab at us.
That was a ridiculous answer. Right. This is pretty similar. I mean, this is on a much lesser scale, but just, you know, things like this happen. This is similar to the Joe Hayden and Urban Meyer said that he was working with Scott Loeffler after practice at quarterback, and Scott Loeffler said he'd never worked with Joe Hayden at the same time. So they just don't get the, you know, they don't pass around the memo. They got to coordinate better before they come out so they know what information they're giving or not giving. Yeah. But, so when stuff like that happens, there's nothing you can do.
The one positive is that they're not all telling it to us, so, like, it can't be filed into the same thing as, like, the Joe Hayden, like, Wildcat or the I-Form talk from 2 years ago where it's like, oh, they're definitely doing this, because now it's like, you know what? They're not even going to bother lying to us that they're definitely going to do it. They're just going to lie to us in one way or the other, and we'll have to do the math on which part is true. Go ahead.
I was just going to – the biggest surprise that I've noticed just for the 3 weeks is that there's been little talk other than Powell about, like, the linebackers.
Yeah.
Is that me? Like, I feel like we got Bostic that one time and some of the other guys, but I just feel like there hasn't been much. They're going to be a big part of the season. Yeah, they're going to Gerald Christian.
Bostic and Jenkins, I think, have been mentioned a decent amount. I mean, they haven't been, like, raved about as some of the other guys have been. But
we just haven't heard Muschamp say that much about it. Like, he said a lot about the D tackles and about Powell.
For what it's worth, they were on that list of, like, 10 to 12 players he named that were, like, having good springs last time we talked to Muschamp, which, you know, again, for what it's worth. But those guys, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's just there's more hype about, like, the young guys just because everybody wants to know. Like, you kind of saw them for a year, so they're not as in vogue as some of these young guys. Right. I don't know.
Yeah, but, I mean, Gerald Christian has been mentioned a couple times, but I feel like that's just for, like, the sake of stories, not necessarily for what he's doing. Because he's listed as a starting linebacker, and, like, I don't know if you really believe – obviously we can't see anything, but I don't know if I really believe that he's going to be there.
Well, it's funny. Every time a Gerald Christian question is asked, it somehow gets back to, well, he's the only guy we got playing both ways, and all Muschamp talks about is his work at tight end, right, playing as this, like, goal line tight end. So we will – I mean, I don't – Elam and some other guys, you know – in there.
Elam had a lot to say.
Struggling conversations did rave about his former buddy, so we shall see.
Right, yeah, that'll be interesting to see. But there has been a lot of love for Sharif Floyd, Dominic Easley, Ronald Powell, those guys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're sort of, like you said, they're in vogue. They're the hot topics right now. I think they're going to probably be one of the more interesting groups to watch, like the D-line, just because I think, depending on what they do with this 4-3-3-4 and I feel like I've been out of the loop. They ever settle? They are doing 4-3 with some 3-4?
I think it's mostly a 3-4, and they're just trying to talk you into the fact that it's going to be a 4-3 most of the time. Like, it's a 3-4.
You can't have a 4-3 and a buck.
Right.
That's a 5. You're running like the West Virginia, like 3-3-5 or 5-2, whatever. I mean, like, it's a 3-4 with Powell playing this, you know, sexy position where he's basically half the time going to be a down lineman. And other half is going to be apparently covering receivers, so we'll see how that works out.
Right, and then moving back into the secondary a little bit, the Janoris Jenkins can't practice right now. He's still recovering from the injury, but he's mentoring the guys, and right now that other cornerback spot is a mix between, like, Jeremy Brown, like the perennial, like, runners-up, like Jeremy Brown, Moses Jenkins, and Cody Riggs vying for the spot.
I mean, this is kind of another let the young guys play situation for me. I actually like Jeremy Brown a lot, but he had a chance last year and didn't do anything with it. So unless he's a lot better this year, which is possible, especially he had a lot of injury stuff, so it could have taken him more than just half a year to get back into full football shape. But Cody Riggs is a guy I really, really like. I don't know if I like him too much, but he's one of my favorites, and I'd love to see him get time. Then you have the two freshmen from last year who haven't been talked about hardly at all, Joshua Shaw and Jalen Watkins, but Shaw was a big recruit, so I don't know what they're planning on doing with him. And then Will Muschamp, of course, is bringing in a class of about 20,000 defensive backs. So, you know, maybe one of them steps up and gets some playing time in their freshman year. But I pretty much think you can throw Moses Jenkins out. Sorry, Moses. And it's between Jeremy Brown and Cody Riggs, if I had to guess.
Fans better hope so, because the fact that they even run out Moses, like, we all saw the FSU game, right? Like,
everyone likes Moses and wants Moses to do well. I'd prefer if Moses was good. Yeah. I like Moses Jenkins. He's been through a lot in his career, injury-wise, especially with the concussion. But he's just not that good, you know? Right. So that's just really what it comes down to.
Muschamp went on a good little rant there about Riggs, but, you know, about his little, like, small corner, big corner.
Well, I wanted, yeah, I actually that was wrote a good question. I wrote something about that because all you hear about is, like, how much Muschamp loves these big corners, and Cody Riggs is obviously a small corner. So I asked both Riggs and Muschamp about it and kind of got to it. And Muschamp was just saying, like, look, I prefer a big corner, but I'll, you know, if you're
who
good.
Doesn't?
Exactly. Who doesn't? It's one of those situations. Like, I prefer my first baseman to hit 45 home runs, but, you know, if he hits 300, or if he hits 300, I'll take 30 instead, you right. know? So it's a little bit of a trade-off with Cody Riggs. He does some things that maybe some bigger corners can't, and I don't know. Muschamp seems pretty happy with him, so.
Right. Yeah, I thought it was a good answer by Muschamp. You know, yeah. It's like, if they make plays, I don't care how tall they are.
Right.
You know? And he listed these guys that are playing in the NFL and McCourt. You know,
well, that he coached. So right, it lends exactly. some credibility so, yeah, to it. Exactly. You know, it's like, I've played short corners before. Look at these guys.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
So I respect that.
Yeah, two guys playing in the NFL now.
I buy that, like, undersized safeties, like the Will Hill types, can do well. But when you're Cody Riggs is like 5'8", something in that range.
5'9".
Like, thank you.
Let's not cheat the guy.
I don't know.
How's Will Hill undersized?
Yeah,
Will
Hill.
I think Mod Black.
Okay. The exact opposite of Will Hill. those kind of, like, I feel like the safety position, you're more able to make plays and, like, overcome for your size with the playmaking ability. But I feel like as a corner in the SEC, you have to be able to match up with the Julio Joneses and the A.J. Greens. Obviously, they won't be around. But those, the bigger receivers that you actually have to match up with one-on-one.
Well, but I mean, like, they're not going to match up Alshon on Cody Riggs.
Right.
I mean, Janoris will take that responsibility. I mean, like, there's been several guys in the SEC that have gotten away with it. Javier Arenas had little skill, and he did pretty darn well at Alabama. He made a career out of being a good punt returner, but he was a good nickel corner. I mean, there's ways to mask, you know, those. Shaw is a big guy, right?
Yeah,
I mean, Shaw's bigger than most of the other guys they have. So he could potentially fill into that role if he lives up to his high expectations, because he was a big time recruit.
In general, size is just overrated. I mean, how many jump balls are there going to be in a game between the cornerback and, you know, the guys Greg named who are leaving for the NFL? But you know, the next wave of big Alshon Jeffrey or is Tolliver still around at LSU? He's
like,
gone too.
It's a
whatever. Whoever the big receivers
see,
are,
I think it's a strength, and it's all about just. It's
I
also
agree.
It's also just about, like, what kind of system Muschamp runs, and I'm not familiar with this particularly, but I don't know. Does he preach his corners to jam more than others? Because if he preaches them to jam more, then, you know, you want a guy to be strong. It doesn't necessarily, if the guy's strong as hell and he's 5'9", it doesn't really matter if he's, you know, 6'2".
From a really basic perspective, here's what I'd like first and foremost out of my corners. Don't let the guy get wide open, which is, you know, it doesn't matter how big you are for that, and be able to tackle in space, you know? Like, and if your guy can do that, then that's, to me, that's 90% of it. You know, everything else is sort of a bonus as far as what you can do. And maybe that makes you the difference between being, you know, serviceable and being great or something. But if you have guys who just are big and physical, and if they're in the right spot for a jump ball, they could play him better, but the guy's already burning him and he's wide open, then what's the difference, you know?
Right.
So.
No, yeah, I completely agree with that. And then you mentioned Ahmad Black earlier, heading into the secondary safety position. Matt Elam is expected to take over for...
Dude, that second safety spot is the, like, least talked about big story of the spring.
Right.
Josh Evans has looked really bad when he's played. I'm just going to say, a lot of people like Evans, but I saw him miss a lot of tackles, be really confused on defense last year, and if that's who you're rolling with, you could have some problems this season.
That got very much overlooked because everybody's very excited about Matt Elam taking over
and
for
Matt
Elam,
I think, is really good.
Right.
But that's not the other spot is really the question.
Right. Who's up for that? I mean, Muschamp is bringing in like 9 defensive backs in the next class. Could any of those guys?
It's
I don't know a whole lot about
be,
him.
I feel
but...
like it's going to have to be one of the young guys maybe that pushes him, but I don't know who among them are good enough. What's that one kid's name he pulled at the All-American game? He got that Jabari Gorman.
Jabari Gorman,
is he maybe good enough? I don't know.
He's played corner. I mean, he's probably got the size and the athleticism to play it. But, I mean, I think, like you said, that's sort of the underrated story of the spring. I think that's a position that's decided in the fall. It's like it's going to have to be because they don't have the bodies.
Yeah, and when you heard about the Burton move to safety, everyone was like, well, that makes sense. They need another safety. You know, like, that makes sense to me. If Burton can play it, they need him bad enough. They need him bad enough to move a fullback to safety. So... But now they're saying, hold on, we're going to leave Burton on offense, but nobody's really talked about the fact that, you know, what are we going to do with that other safety job? So,
all right, let's move on from that, and we're going to do some real quick talk about the NCAA tournament. We got a championship game. Greg, you've been out of work here for a little while. Talk to us about the college basketball scene.
Yeah, if you guys haven't heard, Connecticut and Butler are playing tonight for the national championship in college basketball. The end of this big tournament thing. like 9 o'clock-ish, tune in.
9 o'clock-ish.
Yeah. It, I mean, it
you never really know.
No, yeah.
It should be a good game. I'm looking forward to it. I think Butler's going to have a hard time trying to stop Kemba Walker. I know that they have, I forget his name, I think Norad is a very, very good perimeter defender, so they'll have somebody they can hopefully try to slow him down with. But I think between how good Kemba is and how well Jeremy Lamb's been playing in the tournament, I think Connecticut will be able to pull it out tonight.
Anybody else? Anybody want to weigh in? Your prediction?
I don't like Kemba at all. I don't know if it's fair or not, but I just really can't stand him. But if he wins, I have to give him credit for having a great year and leading his team to a championship, which will clearly have been the case. But I'm hoping Butler pulls it out and gets a championship. I really can't be any higher on Butler and Brad Stevens. Brad Stevens is like the golden child as far as I'm concerned. He's like the greatest coach in America. So I hope Butler wins it. It'd be a great end to their run.
Yeah.
Wait, what's wrong with Kemba?
He's just so arrogant. It's unbelievable. Like, he's just the most arrogant person I've ever seen in my entire life.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
By far. Like, there was a shot. I'll always remember this face. There's a shot where he's on the free throw line, right? This is during, I think, the Big East tournament. And he shoots his first free throw and, like, makes it. And the first official bounces the ball back to him. And he goes to, like, go into his routine. And the official behind him, like, I don't know why the official did this, but he ran in and took the ball away from him. And, like, I don't know what's going on. He's obviously trying to, like, hold up play, maybe to get a sub in or something like that. And Kemba just looked at him with this face of, like, disgust. Like, give me my ball back. Like, it was so, like, disrespectful towards authority and just, like he just made this face. Like, he just scrunched it up and, like, what the hell are you doing? Like, white guy. It was, like, one of those looks, you know? Like, give me that ball back. Like, I'll tell you when I shoot my free throws, that kind of thing. And you just add in, like, all that stuff with, like, he's constantly celebrating, going nuts in a very, like, it's not like a fun, like, college-y kind of celebration. It's like a real, like, trying to be hard, like, show everybody up. I don't know. That's the impression I get off him.
He's a very big fan of himself.
Absolutely.
He's the biggest fan of himself, perhaps.
Absolutely.
And, you know, he's very good. He's extremely talented. But, yeah, he's a little much at this point.
I'm not a Kemba fan. A little humility goes a long way. Right. And he has none, as far as I'm concerned. So.
Yep. Zing!
Yeah.
I can't stand UConn either, but I don't really particularly have a problem with Kemba. I don't like Calhoun at all.
Like Calhoun.
So I am definitely cheering for the Bulldog Butler Bulldogs tonight. Hopefully, crazy Matt Howard will pull some magic out of his hat, and hopefully Butler will take it. I mean, I think I understand why UConn is a slight favorite, but. Hopefully, Brad Stevens and the Magic can continue.
Right. I think Lamb's really underrated for UConn. I think he's a really good player and a real matchup nightmare. So, I don't know. If he has a big game, I don't know who on Butler kind of match up with him. Because maybe Mac can sort of do a good job matching up with Walker, but I don't really see who's guarding Lamb on that team.
Basically, we can all admit that Calipari just blew the last game. So, Kentucky should be in this game.
Brandon Knight blew the last game. Brandon Knight was terrible.
Yeah. Like, Calipari, the last 2 minutes coaching in that game was just atrocious. The way he coached the last 2 minutes in that game.
In what way? Just the
plays? How do you not get the plays? I don't understand. Kentucky's Lamb was the best player that they had all game, and they didn't give him the ball again, like in the last 2 minutes. They didn't even let him touch the ball in the last 2 minutes. It made no sense. He got them back in that game with three straight threes and a couple of, like, Calipari made some good coaching calls, calling some off-ball screens and getting him to run little quick hook plays. But, I mean, I didn't understand why, you know, they just went blindly with Brandon Knight.
I know the Liggins shot at the end of that game was awful.
Like, yeah.
It was just not a good decision.
Well, they didn't even call a play. They called a timeout, and then they didn't run a play. It was kind of like
Donovan,
the Billy Donovan five guys stand around.
Call a timeout. He knows he's not going to call a play. We need to waste our time not calling.
He knows
play.
His weaknesses.
We can just do it.
He trusts his players to not call the play. That's bold. Two things I want to say. First, a question. Do you know anybody who's like preparing for this game? Be like, God, I hope UConn beats these like pesky upstart Bulldogs. Like, do you know anybody in this game who's like for UConn, who wants UConn to win?
Greg.
I mean, I know. A
right.
Bunch
well,
of
other. Yeah.
Go
well,
to UConn.
Right. Get that out. But I'm saying, like, is like the national consensus, like,
yeah, everybody wants Butler to win for good reason.
Exactly.
Well, I thought everybody had already decided Butler wasn't the pesky upstart anymore.
Well, they're not, but like, you know, the relative underdog.
I guess
an 8 seed.
I just want to throw this question out there because it has felt this way to me, not just this season, but the last several. Is it just me or Is the Final Four kind of like almost anticlimactic to the rest of the tournament? I feel like everything else is so big because there's so many games, and there's all these buzzer beaters, and there's always that, even the Elite Eight weekend. You know, you have there's all these games back to back, and you get the big, and then it's like, oh, then we have to wait a whole week for two games, and then you know the first one wasn't that good. You know, the VCU Butler game really wasn't particularly good. I don't know. It just almost seems anticlimactic to me now.
Yeah, it is. It is every single year because the problem is that I spend so much time the first couple weekends watching basketball for 12 hours straight for 4 days in a row that you're just watching so much basketball that when it's like, okay, I get two games in this round and I'm done, or the Elite Eight, you get four games for the whole round, you're just like, you're going to withdrawal, you know? It's not enough basketball compared to the rest of the tournament.
Yeah. And it's almost like you lose interest over that week that, like, you've been waiting because normally, you know, you're getting the games earlier, you're getting, you know, you're getting them on several days, but then you're just waiting for one day and it's all the way at the end of it. I mean, it's
disappointing.
Yeah. Honestly, another part of it is that I think a lot of people's brackets are done by then, and that generates so much interest in the opening rounds that, like, you get to the Final Four. Yeah. Your picks don't really matter anymore. You already lost or you already won, and then...
Yeah, this all definitely adds up. It all adds up.
It's definitely a good point. The other thing, too, is, like, you get solid first round. Like, a 5-12 game can be very close to the point where, like, can you get to an Elite Eight game that's not as close, it's not as interesting. It's like, you know, I've already watched better basketball, like, for entertainment value, so... I don't know, it's not quite as emotionally investing.
As far as Butler not being the upstart anymore, like whoever's writing that is just like really wrong. Like I think they feel like they're giving Butler like credit, like oh, we should give them more credit, or like they feel like they're defending Butler's honor, but really they're just marginalizing like one of the greatest accomplishments in the history of the NCAA tournament. Like going Brad Stevens taking this team to back-to-back finals is unparalleled, maybe, as far as like runs from a school of that caliber. Their enrollment is 4,500 kids, and they're recruiting. It's not like they did pretty well. See, they're everything. I tweeted this. They're everything that Gonzaga never became. Like Gonzaga, like made a couple runs. They had like one or two good players, but then Gonzaga started recruiting like good players, like NBA guys. Gonzaga has NBA guys every single year, and like Austin they're getting like. Yeah, Austin Day, like Harris this year, Sacre. Yeah. Who was their center? The white guy with a bunch of tattoos. It was really good.
Ooh.
From a couple years ago. Heitfeld,
yeah.
And then Pargo. Like, they've just had... Yeah. Matt Bolden was really good. Like, they're recruiting, like, 3-4-star guys. Like, guys that, like, other powerhouses are recruiting. And they could never put it together. Butler... Who on that team was like a big time high school recruit that they went out and got? They're winning with talent that nobody else would take. Shelvin Mack is from Lexington, Kentucky. Can you imagine somebody from Gainesville not getting recruited by Florida, going to some mid-major school, and then leading them to back-to-back championship games? And this is when before Kentucky had Calipari. Kentucky wasn't too good to take Shelvin Mack back then. Are you kidding me? They're in the MIT.
Right.
He wasn't as good as like Crawford and Ramel Bradley. Are you kidding me?
Ramel Bradley.
The less good Crawford.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I just feel like what they're doing, and they lost their best player from last year. When the championship game happened, they were like, man, if Gordon Hayward stays and everybody stays, they can come back and maybe compete again. Gordon Hayward leaves, everyone writes them off, rightfully so. They have no business being where they are talent-wise.
At the beginning.
But I mean, this is just really like, this is absolutely incredible. And to say that Butler is like too good for this kind of praise is absolutely ridiculous. Brad Stevens is doing one of the best coaching jobs we've seen in my lifetime for sure, and probably dating back a long time before me.
Right. I'd say potentially ever, just because
potentially ever.
You think about that. Like you said, losing Gordon Hayward, like, we all wrote this team off. You know, it was a nice story last year. They made it back. You know, it was great coaching then with that team. Then they lost their best player. And then it's like, how are you? Unprecedented.
It's baffling. It's unbelievable what they've been able to do. It really takes away from what they're doing to say that, like, to even pretend that somehow they're on the same landscape of even Gonzaga or Xavier. Like they will be now, and they will probably recruit a lot better, but this team with this talent is not those teams.
Right,
they're not as talented as those teams. They're winning with really a team attitude and playing defense and locking people down.
All right, here's what if they lose? How is this? Is it still remembered just as
fondly?
Yeah,
I think it's still pretty incredible. You kind of need to – if you win one early – I was talking about this with somebody last night – especially for Brad Stevens, like his coaching legacy, if you get those early, it really, you can ride those forever.
Exactly.
Like, people will really be talking about Butler, like, forever. He'll always be remembered. Somebody will make a documentary about this. But if he loses.
Like, Bob Knight didn't win and, you know, won a couple early and then didn't win.
And you just ride those out. You ride those suckers out. Like, Brett Favre, you could be a legend for the rest of your career. But if you don't get those early, then you kind of get. It's not the same hype. So
you're
this is really important for Brad Stevens' legacy, this game.
When does he leave? When does he?
Apparently never, which is makes us even sweeter, right. Because we haven't seen a program built from the ground up in a while, and it looks like Butler might be heading that way. I mean, he's under like a 12-year some hockey contract over there where he plays the rest of his natural life, and then they euthanize him or something. But it's really incredible. Like, supposedly he's not going anywhere, which is unbelievable. I think he'd get any job he wants, and he's a guy who, if he wins this one. Anytime UNC and if Duke Kansas, comes open, if Kansas comes open, anytime he can go wherever he wants after this.
So, yeah, I think, I mean, all the crazy connections between Billy and Butler, that if, like, Billy ever took an NBA job, I mean, like, Florida would be, you know, would definitely be call Stevens first. Well, I think they would call Stevens first. I mean, people would be like Anthony Grant, but Stevens would absolutely get the first call, and they would throw the...
You should get everyone's first call. Right. Yeah. He's awesome, dude. He's so good. Like, I don't have enough good things to say about him.
And I feel like he signed that 8-year extension or whatever it was since the last run. Like, it's not like he's, like, still in this old contract and he can leave whenever and he's going to. Like, he signed the extension to stay there since becoming the big name that everybody wants.
Right. Conversely, I'm pretty disappointed that Shaka is signed to stay at VCU. I don't understand that at all.
Did he say that?
Yeah. Yeah, he announced it. Apparently, Greg Doyle and other guys are reporting it today that has officially turned down NC State or something like that. I don't understand why he would stay. I mean, all the guys are leaving. He's literally playing with house money at this point. No one knows if he's actually that good. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, they went on one hell of a run, and no one knows if, like, he next year, to save his own, talk about his legacy, he has to make the tournament next year. Like, he just has to make it. It doesn't matter if he loses in the first round. VCU has to make the tournament next year. That's going to be hard. Losing Skeen and Rodriguez, and, you know, I mean, it's a senior laden team.
Right.
So.
Right, but if he really is good, then the money will still be there. So that's.
But you can sell high now,
which is what you should do.
That's why
Mullen should have got out of Starkville.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like, if NC State isn't like a wretched program, he can go there, and I mean, you're definitely living in the shadows of.
I get not going to NC State. I do have some respect for NC State, but to me, that could also be a bad situation. You're in a lot of school shadows there. But if, like, Tennessee offered him and he turned that down, then you kind of got to wonder what he's shooting for.
Like an Arkansas type. I don't know if that was on the table, but I would go to an Arkansas firm. I would play Anthony Grant.
There's no way he would turn down Arkansas.
No?
There's no way.
Do you think Arkansas is more attractive than Tennessee?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes. Because I think they both have good – they both have uprising fan bases. They both have, you know, pretty good facilities, but Arkansas has more history than Tennessee.
Yeah, Arkansas does have more history.
And I think a good coach, not to belittle Pelfrey, but I think a good coach can do well at Arkansas.
That's true. I would not want to get involved in the Tennessee athletic scene at all right now. That's a good point.
Yeah,
but the program as a whole is more prestigious, and that's why I think you and I had the same reaction to Tennessee probably being a better job.
I'd probably rather end up at Tennessee, but the stuff about, like, sanctions and stuff, you don't really know what's going to happen there, so that might sway me one way or the other. But Tennessee's been better recently, obviously.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think it's easier to sell kids on coming to Knoxville than Fayetteville, but, I mean,
And that's definitely true, and that's why, even despite all this hoopla that Pearl's been involved with, I mean, he deserves some credit for – I mean, Tennessee was nothing before he got there. Right. Men's basketball was nothing, and he really, you know, has made that, aside from the possible sanctions, a good job to have and or get. So we shall see.
One more thing about Brad Stevens before we move on. We talked about Butler, like, becoming a legitimate top-tier program. If the top coach really wants to stay there and, like, they continue to succeed, then maybe they really can become, like, the top-tier program. Because I feel like if it's actually becoming the program that people want to say it's becoming, then of course he's going to stay there. But, like, the fact that there's all the talk about him leaving – is like, well, then it's not on that level if that's not the kind of job you would want to hold on to for all those years, you know?
There's a lot of things that are, like, involved with it, and, like, what you consider,
like,
a top-tier opponent. Yeah, exactly, the budget, the facilities, how much you can actually get, you know, are you getting paid your worth? You just, as Kyle eloquently said, he's done an unprecedented run. Like, whether most people want to be paid what they're worth, and, you know, can Butler sustain that over a long period of time?
I mean, I'm really curious just to see what kind of kids they can recruit after this. I think it all hinges on that, to be honest. Like, if they can start bringing in, like, top-tier talent or guys who, you know, really have a chance to make it to the league every year, then there's no reason why they can't be a great program.
Right. But, I mean, the other thing, too, is where do they go next year? Because that's, you know, like, you can put this together, but if they don't get – you know, you want to talk about being a top-tier program, you have top-tier expectations, and if you lose in the second round of the tournament, is that a disappointment? And, you know, going forward, you have to recruit the talent to get you past that every year. I think that's sort of where it goes from here. All right, let's move on, talk a little bit of Florida baseball. We got Jesse here. We're getting into about that time of the year when spring football is going to be over and basketball is already over. Going to be looking at a lot of baseball. Jesse, what's going on with the Gators? Not top-ranked anymore?
No, not top-ranked. They scuffled last. They lost 3 out of 4 last weekend, then including this past Tuesday's loss to FSU. But then they swept Tennessee at home this weekend. Hudson Randall pitched one of the best games I've ever seen. Took him 74 pitches to throw a 4-hit complete game. I mean, it was just Greg Maddux-like with his control. Tennessee helped him out by being the most over-aggressive team I've ever seen, swinging at nearly every first pitch, it seemed like. But, I mean, Hudson was just dealing, and they easily won that game. And then the bullpen pitched really well and really saved Florida on Saturday and Sunday, bailing out Brian Johnson, who pitched all right on Saturday, but Discofani came in and put out the fire. And then yesterday, Tommy Toledo escaped huge jam where there was runners on second and third in a 1-0 ball game, and Florida didn't give up a run and ended up, you know, routing Tennessee by busting the bats open in the 6th and 7th inning. So Florida scuffled with the bats lately. The pitching has been there, whether it's been the bullpen or the starters, has been there pretty much all season, but they have really struggled at the plate over about the past 10 days, I'd say. And this series against Tennessee, they kind of busted out of that. So we'll see what happens.
This is more or less what we expected at the beginning of the year, though, because all the talk was about the pitching and how the pitching was going to be solid.
Right.
Is there anything in particular in the lineup that's been disappointing that they haven't got that they expected? Or
yeah,
is this...
I think the lineup overall has been actually pretty darn disappointing. I think because there was as much talk as there was about the pitching, O'Sullivan always tempered that with, like, hey, our lineup's damn good. Like, top to bottom, we're as good or better than almost anybody else. And if you look at what their expectations and or what their past numbers have been, you could put some merit into that. But Brian Johnson this year has struggled mightily. Last year, he didn't start. He was, you know, the big guy that came in and played both ways and did whatever, and he hit like almost hit over 400 or whatever. I mean, he didn't start hitting until right at the beginning of SEC play, but he hasn't done really anything this year. He's dropped all the way down to like the 7th hole. Austin Maddux only has 2 home runs. He had 17 or 18 last year. Zunino
the
has
bats, man.
Yeah, so they wouldn't blame the bats at all, and now there's been some, you know, some creeping of doubt from guys that are like, well, maybe it's the bats. It's like, well, you didn't, you know, when everything was going good, you didn't want to blame it on the, you know, you said, oh, it has nothing to do with the bats. We're just hitting the ball well.
Right.
But now Preston Tucker struggled a little bit, but he's coming out of it. Nolan Fontana has been like the biggest mystery. He leads the team in RBIs and has a super high on base percentage. But, I mean, he'll go through these wax slumps where he'll go 1 for 18 and then he'll bust out for 8 RBIs in like the next 2 nights. So consistency is what they're trying to find there.
Just I haven't gotten to watch any baseball this year, to be completely honest. But looking at the stat sheet, they're hitting 314 and they're scoring 6 runs a game, it looks like. So when you say the line has been completely disappointed,
but you're scoring 22,
you're
scoring 22 against,
Winthrop,
Eastern Eugene, whoever the hell it was, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and that was, you know, Tyler got some criticism for his column because he didn't delve deep enough into the stats. But basically, Florida has struggled over the season hitting with runners in scoring position. Too often, they'll get the bases loaded on, you know, 2 singles and a walk, or they'll, you know, have runners at second and third and no outs, and they only get 1 run. So they've struggled getting the big hit. They have not, bats be damned, whatever, you know, whatever the problem is. They haven't hit a lot of home runs this season. So we'll see. Timely hitting is what they keep saying they're working on. I don't know how you work
on
timely hitting.
Yeah.
I mean, like Greg, I've watched no baseball this year just because it's not in my job description. But, I mean, do you really believe in, like, the whole, like, big hit, clutch hit type thing? I mean, that's something you can't really control,
right.
I think. Some people do. I think you can definitely kind of shrink in big situations sometimes. But I think in general, like, the sample size ends up being so small that it's just a matter of circumstance. You know, you don't... like Jesse said, there's nothing you can do to be like a better clutch hitter, really. Like, you're trying every time you go up there, you're just not getting it. So
they're not working on that in practice, because like, how do you work on that in practice? I put runners on second and third, and this is exactly the same way you're going
to
hit, no matter what.
It's hard to simulate those sort of situations. So we'll see. I mean, they're a good team. The Florida's a really good team. They're ranked 3 or 4. I haven't looked, checked the latest rankings that came out today. No, see, that's the other thing. Florida just can't beat FSU. Florida's season would actually look a lot better this year. Losing 2 out of 3 to the defending national champions in South Carolina last weekend, it wasn't – I mean, like, you're going to lose some ball games. Right. You're not going to go 60-0, you know. I mean, they play 60 games. They're not going to win every single one. But the disheartening thing is FSU is a good team, and if they meet FSU in the College World Series again like they did last year – there would, in my estimation, there's little hope Florida would win. FSU totally has their number. Florida, historically, both in the past couple seasons since O'Sullivan has been there and definitely this season, just cannot seem to beat FSU on neutral fields. And Florida just can't hit, and it was kind of shown earlier when they were struggling both in FSU and versus South Carolina. Florida can't hit any pitcher that throws breaking balls. Like, FSU just has a bunch of junk pitchers. They don't have a lot of guys that throw hard. FSU throws the guys that, you know, just throw nasty changeups and just sliders in the dirt and stuff like that. And Florida just swings over the top or swings and misses. Hmm. And that's why Florida's lost, you know, several times to FSU the past couple seasons, including twice already this year.
What's their record against FSU this year?
They're 1-2, and it took – I mean, they had a big comeback game at home, which was like the longest game of my life. Adam, that was the one game Adam had to cover this year. That was pretty funny, but that – They had a big – that was a big comeback win, and they were so jacked up to win that game. It was like they had just, you know, clinched a final or something. They were so jacked up to finally be – it was like an albatross was lifted off their back, and then 2 weeks later they lose to him again. Yeah. So. Mm-hmm.
Was that the win that was important for many reasons?
That win was important for many reasons, according to the Alligator newspaper. I do want to talk about other Florida news on the diamond, though. The softball team has lost 6 in a row.
Tailspin.
Yeah. Like, you want to talk unprecedented. I don't think they ever got swept in the time the three of us, Kyle, me, and then Greg, covered the team.
Yeah, I don't think they ever lost 2 out of 3.
Right. I can't remember them losing a series. And all of a sudden, they've lost 6 in a row.
You don't get swept with Stacy Nelson.
Right,
I'll tell you that. I don't know. I can't speak for last year, but
He didn't – I don't – yeah, like you said, you can't even remember them losing 2 out of 3. No. But Stephanie Brombacher, somebody asked to send an email last week to give an update on her. She got some sort of bicep injury that is very vague and mysterious. She's going to probably have a procedure at some point if Will Muschamp were coaching this team, and she will probably be healthy at some point. But honestly, we don't know. Hannah Rogers is pitching and just getting absolutely rocked.
And she was doing so well earlier this year.
She was 16-1 to start the year, and now she's just in an absolute – like, she gave up 24 runs in 3 games.
She faced Georgia last week and just got shellacked. Right. And this weekend they got killed by Kentucky.
And she didn't even play in all those Georgia games because she was suspended, and they had to pitch their third baseman at one point. Like, things are not looking too good for the Florida softball team right now.
In defense of Hannah Rogers, I mean, having to pitch every inning of a series got to be kind of tough on the arm. Like, I could understand if you kind of had a few letdowns in there.
I mean, college softball is honestly as close to, like, basketball as you can get with, like, one person affecting the game. Like, you're only as good as your best pitcher at 100%. So, I mean, if they can't get Brombacher back healthy and pitching at a pretty high level, then you can't win. You can't do it, especially in the postseason when your offense, even the great offenses, can only generate 3, 4, 5 runs.
Right.
There's just no chance.
And it really is a mystery, this injury. I mean, like, last week, Sheehan reported that Brombacher was, like, warming up in the bullpen for said games against Georgia, yet she never pitched.
Right.
And then she doesn't pitch again a week later versus Kentucky. I mean, I don't know.
Right.
So.
Yeah, some mysterious stuff is happening around the Florida softball program, including them losing 6 in a row.
6 in a row is epic. Who else did they lose to? I know they got swept by Georgia.
And then Kentucky.
Kentucky swept them? They got swept in back-to-back series. What did Walton say after that?
he was disappointed.
Yeah, I believe he said, watching us play, it was real tough to swallow.
Holy crap.
Yeah, like, Tim Walton, not a happy man right now. All right, we don't actually have an intro to sports journalism topic to move into here. I do want to thank some listener emails. We got one from a former Alligator employee, Stephanie Slade, up in Washington, D.C. She wanted to be recognized as a fan. I really appreciate everybody who's been listening since the beginning. Speaking of which, we got another email from my man, Vince Fagnola, coming to us live from Austin, Texas now. He's been to Alaska. Now he's back in the continental states, in Austin. And You had a lot to say. Vince, really appreciate your emails. Keep those coming in. Send them to podcast@alligator.org. But we're going to go ahead and move into the weekly awards. Major Wright Awards for Excellence in the Field of Sport and Wandy Pierre-Louis Bad Angles of the Week. I'm going to start off with my major, and then we're going to move around, do something a little different this time. I'm going to give my major to a friend of the podcast, Ed Ashoff, who started at ESPN.com, working for the SEC blog with Chris Lowe. I guess today was officially his first day, and that's a huge, huge accomplishment. He really deserves it. It's a great thing for him. He's going to be covering the whole SEC. You can check him out on ESPN.com now. I'm really, really excited to say I know him and very proud of him.
As much as we crap on ESPN, they did something good by hiring Ed. Ed's like one of my really good friends. We hang out, you know, outside of just reporting and stuff like that. He's really great at his job. He did good work at the Sun, and you know, congrats to him. So he's been on the podcast before, and hopefully you guys can have him back too, you know, as an ESPN guy.
ESPN's own.
He's a real genuinely chill dude. He's a good guy. And unfortunately he's not starting today because his grandfather just passed away.
Wow, of course.
Yeah. His ESPN debut will be delayed just a couple of days. He's flying up to Iowa today. So
best wishes our condolences to Ed.
But still, congratulations on the move. It's very exciting. And let's go to Greg for your major.
Okay. Now, let me start by saying I have little to no respect for women's basketball.
I thought you were just going to say women. I really thought you were just going to say women.
Somewhere in that range. I'm not going to respond to that.
Also true.
But plausible deniability. Yeah.
Still want to give my major to Maya Moore, because, I mean, I know UConn lost, but she wrapped up one of the greatest careers in the history of women's college basketball, so little shout-out to her.
That's a nice Bonnell senior high shirt you're wearing there, Greg. Shout-out to Connecticut.
Yep, shout-out to Connecticut. It's going to be another shout-out Connecticut to edition part two.
All right, wow. Jesse,
well, please
give us something less shameful.
Well, I really don't have anything good, but I just thought that Hudson Randall's probably been one of the more unappreciated athletes around the SEC and at Florida. I mean, he is just dominating. His ERA is 0.5.
What?
He's 5-0.
Is that serious?
Yeah, that is serious.
0.5 on the season?
He has not given up one earned run in SEC play. I mean, I've written about him a lot, but I just, you know, I think that what he's doing is just ridiculous, and so I'm giving him some love.
Well-deserved, yeah.
0.5. I mean, it is ridiculous.
Good God. All right, so then that concludes
back-to-back complete games for the first time since, like, 2004 or something.
What year is
like
he?
That. He's a sophomore.
Okay.
Jeez.
And what's funny is that his ceiling, like, I don't know what really his pro ceiling, like, isn't that high because he doesn't have overwhelming stuff.
Right.
He's
very much in control.
Is he a lefty?
No, he's right-handed. He's just, like, a pinpoint control right-hander that just understands that if you nibble on the corners and, you know, throw a lot of off-speed stuff and control your fastball, they'll put the ball in play and hit it to your infielder. So, I mean, he's pitching damn good right now.
Wow. That concludes the major portion of our show. We're going to move on to the Wandies. Kyle, you got two. Get us with one.
All right. I got a lot of stuff to hate on right now. I'll start with Cashman because it's way more focused. But GM of the Yankees, Brian Cashman, full disclosure, I am a Mets fan, as I'm sure I've talked about on this podcast before. But originally, I saw a headline on ESPN that was something like, Cashman calls Mets use of Feliciano last year abusive. And for a split second, I forgot that Feliciano wasn't on the Mets anymore, that he was on the Yankees. Like, I knew that, but for just a second, I didn't. And I agreed with Cashman, and I was like, yeah, absolutely, it was abusive. Like, they've done it before. If you're familiar with the Mets, Fernando Nieve, they did the same thing, too. They pitched him every day, then he got injured, and they cut him. And Feliciano, they've thrown every day for 3 years. So he's 100% right. They abuse the crap out of their relievers. And in almost like a stupid way, it's like you know, Jerry Manuel is always like, you know, Feliciano, he's a guy who likes to pitch every day. And it's like, well, it's your job to not pitch him every day. Like, he's not just walking out to the mound and taking the ball. So anyway.
Give me the ball. Skip.
When I thought that Feliciano was still on the Mets, I was like, yeah, absolutely. Like, some reporter must have asked Brian Cashman what he thought, because maybe they're having to talk about bullpen usage. And they're in New York, they brought that up, and Cashman offered an honest opinion. Can't fault the guy for that. But then, you know, I read the story and stuff, and I realize I'm stupid. Obviously, Feliciano signed a 2-year, $8 million contract with the Yankees. He tweaked his shoulder or something during spring training, and he's on the 15-day DL. So what really is happening here is Cashman signed a guy who he knows has thrown every day for the last 3 years to an $8 million contract, brought him in, he got hurt, surprise, surprise, and now he's upset. Now he's upset that the Mets have used him. Dude, you did not have to sign him and put him on your team. It's absolutely insane that you're whining about this. Also, Joe Torre, like, would pitch guys every day also. Girardi's the exact opposite. He, like, saves guys' arms. Right. But the other thing that I want to say, too, is, like, they interviewed Mets coach Dan Worthen, their pitching coach, and he said one of the reasons we didn't want to bring Feliciano back was because we know he led the majors in appearances each of the last 3 years. But something else to realize is he's never thrown more than 65 innings. He's a lefty specialist. He'll come in, get a guy out, and then, you know, get yanked. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, too, there is some credibility from a major league player who's getting paid for his services. If you don't want to pitch because you're concerned about your arm, you need to say something. This isn't a high school kid. It's not a high school coach, you know, where you need to protect the kid first and foremost. Like, the Mets need to win first and foremost, and Feliciano has some accountability to just say, look, I'm trying to save my arm here. I'd like to have a long major league career.
Right.
Now, with that said, Feliciano has not complained at all, and I like Pedro Feliciano a lot. But, yeah, Cashman, way out of line with this. What? Like, couldn't be just crying anymore about a decision that he knowingly made. Nobody hid this from him. This isn't a guy who failed a physical after he was purported to be healthy. So just shut up, Brian Cashman, and that's my Wandy.
This is a guy who got into a relationship with a crazy girl, and it's like, wait, she's crazy? Like, how did this happen?
Yeah, right?
I don't understand.
This is unfair.
Right, exactly. No track record of this. I'm going to go ahead and give my Wandy. We'll come back to Kyle for his last one at the end. Mine's related to baseball, not nearly as strong. I'm going to give this to the start of my fantasy baseball season. It couldn't have started off worse, first of all, because I missed my first draft, and we had to have a friend take it over because the night in the office got hectic and the podcast crashed and the video show got delayed. And then I drafted, essentially for my second league, the 2010 Tampa Bay Rays featuring Manny Ramirez. So a little bit of the Tampa Bay Rays in general. And then everybody got hurt. Just everybody on that team got hurt. I've got, I think, six guys DL eligible.
Really?
Crawford, Longoria, Lidge, Wilson, Jurgens, somebody else, yeah. So my fantasy baseball season, really not off to a hot start. But unlike some of the Boston writers, I'm not going to write that one off already. So that'll cue up. Jesse, you want to go?
Well, that leads perfectly into my rant. We're 3 days into the baseball season, and people are already jumping off the cliff about their team's seasons. And it kills me. It's just like, are you kidding me? Today, reading both articles on ESPN and SI, and then watching SportsCenter and First Take this morning, Rob Parker and Skip Bayless were already freaking out because their picks of
the All-Star team.
Yeah, it's a hell of a squad.
Rob Parker, nice guy, by the way.
Their preseason picks, and lots of people's preseason picks, you know, the Red Sox struggled this weekend, and it's like, it's three games. I mean, talk to me when we're at the end of May, if they're still scuffling, but there's 150 something, you know, more to go. I don't understand. You know, it is baseball. You're gonna go through some, you know, swells and some ups and downs. And when you're already jumping off the ledge because of, you know, some poor losses to a good team. I mean, they didn't lose.
Yeah, Rangers were in the World Series last year.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and it was in Arlington. It's, right. it's like, are you kidding? I mean, it's like they're not losing five games, and I mean, like, it just kills me. So that's my rant.
Well said.
A lot
well
of reacts said. In the world of baseball. A lot of instant reactions. It's a long season. Everybody can just calm down. Greg?
All right. Mine's going to go to the whole NFL labor thing because that's still going on. I told myself.
Oh, you just brought it to fans' attention. They all forgot.
I told myself I'm not going to worry about it until the college basketball season ends. That's going to happen in like 10 hours, and then I'm going to have to figure out why there might not be football next year. And that's not going to be fun. So it goes to the NFL.
Crunch some numbers and figure out why there's not
going
to be
I just
football.
Picture this moment where Greg, like,
Greg's going to become Rain Man to go like figure this shit out.
I picture a moment where like one shining moment plays, and then Greg just starts crying uncontrollably.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
He can't handle the world without
exactly.
football. And then you just go to the internet and you're just trying to crunch numbers and make everything happen.
Maybe the draft will hold me over, but then after that,
that's going to be depressing because like nobody's going to be there, right?
I think they're all going.
Oh, they are all going now.
They're going.
Great.
My favorite thing on TV is when you still they're like breaking down last year's draft class and projecting this year's. It's like they're still pretending. Well, we still have to talk about something, and they just keep going with it. It's like. Gee, I don't understand why ESPN did it 3 years ago anyway. Is it like NFL Live is 365 days?
Right.
I was about to say, what's NFL Live up to now?
But they're still kicking, man. They bring back every, like, former retread player to just talk about stuff they have no idea.
Sean King, everybody.
It's so terrible. Or, like, what they do is, like, if something happens in another sport, they try to, like, relate that to, like, the best moments in football or something. So, like, you know, if a crazy, like, last-minute shot, you know, happens in basketball, like, that gets us thinking about the greatest last-minute finishes in football history. Here's a top 10. Like, crap like that.
Opening day, everybody.
Just killing 10-minute right. segments.
Exactly.
What does Schlera think about, the opening, like, the greatest opening day in football history?
Right.
Oh, I have another quick one.
Great football opening days.
But before Kyle gets to his quick one, you know, we talked about it and laughed about it, but about the Fab Five documentary, but Jalen Rose got kicked off the air. I don't know if you guys heard about that. He's off the air because he lied about his DUI because it happened like literally either the night before or the night after the Fab Five documentary, and he didn't tell anybody at ESPN.
Oh no,
nice.
So they've pulled his plug.
No,
this is
horrible news.
He can't go on there and rant about Uncle Tom's and you know this, that, and the other. So
that had to happen.
Lost a great one.
Yeah. Kyle. Bring us home.
Another one. All right, this is very unfocused and very broad, but I'm very upset with the NCAA. I mean, in general, I'm always upset with the NCAA, but I choose not to think about it to try to keep myself sane and happy. But, you know, with the recent HBO Real Sports on, you know, players getting paid and the labor situation with college athletes and stuff like that, very good piece, very informative, very true. And I also watched a documentary yesterday about UNLV, also an HBO thing, an HBO documentary on UNLV and Jerry Tarkanian and that team that won a championship and stuff. And they just, like, tortured Jerry Tarkanian while he's there, like, just because they could, pretty much. And Tarkanian has this rep as, like, this really dirty coach, even though his banners are still flying, they never took anything back. They banned them from postseason play. It was supposed to be the year they defended their title, and they pushed it back a year. Yeah. So right there, it's like, obviously it wasn't that serious and terrible if you let them defend their title and push it back a year. And then the smoking gun, they paid Jerry Tarkanian $2.5 million in 1998 to settle a lawsuit for harassment that Jerry Tarkanian filed with them. You don't pay somebody $2.5 million if you did nothing wrong, in my expert legal opinion. Reed, I have no expert legal opinion. But that's to me, like, I just really can't stand the NCAA. And a point that we can discuss that I wanted to bring up was graduation rates. And this just isn't the NCAA. This is kind of like – this sort of is a sports journalism talk, if we can maybe get into this. But I feel like coaches – like, one of the things in the Tarkanian thing was he was graduating, like, none of his players – but the players he was taking in were guys who, you know, let's be honest, maybe didn't belong in college in the first place. Not that they were bad kids. Nobody on his team was, like, you know, assaulting people, stealing stuff, doing stuff like that. But they just came from really rough backgrounds, and maybe they didn't have the best education systems. So anyway, my point is this. I don't know what percentage of students Florida graduates as a university as a whole.
Right.
But, I mean, what do we think? It can't be higher than, what, 60, 75%?
60 is the number that comes to mind, yeah.
Okay, so let's say it's 60%. Why are college coaches – why is Urban Meyer and Billy Donovan responsible for graduating 90% of their players, 100% of their players? It's like, to me, the universities are telling these guys, like, win however you can, bring in whoever you need to, relaxing their standards. And then if those kids aren't able to graduate, it's like this huge issue – where, to me, you're holding them to a higher standard than the general population, which seems unfair. And just because I know my opinion's sort of slanted here because I still haven't graduated. I pretty much dropped out of school to take a job. Not that I failed out, so I can still go back and get my degree if I want to. But my point being, just because you didn't graduate because you went on to play in the league or something and you took money when you can doesn't mean you can't go back and get your degree. It also doesn't mean that your time in college wasn't productive. You know, if they were good citizens and they never did anything wrong and they went to class and stuff like that and they ended up not graduating, how is that any different from anybody else who's not graduating? I just feel like the double standard there is, like, really unfair.
I think the argument that you're going to get, and it's not particularly valid here, at least because of all the scholarships we're able to get, is, like, these people, they're getting their educations paid for, you know, and, like, there's not a money.
But
so are we. So that's what I'm saying. That argument doesn't hold up at Florida or as much, you know, as in big public state schools. It doesn't really hold up because, like, they are getting their education paid for, and the expectation is that if you are given this free ride to come here and get a degree,
but what's
you can
it,
get
there's
it.
A big di- and Jerry Tarkanian said this, and we've all been in college, and there's no way we don't all agree on this. Anybody who's been to college hopefully does. There's a huge difference between graduating a player and educating a player. a huge difference.
Oh, absolutely.
Just because you did enough to, like, stay on top of a guy, tutor him, you know, maybe bend the rules, do whatever you need to do to get him a diploma, that doesn't mean you bettered his life, you furthered his opportunities, you did anything for him. It doesn't mean it's a win-win situation. So I just, this graduation rate thing to me is just, like, way overblown.
Right. Here's my, what are scholarships good for? Are they good for years? Are they good for, like...
The way they work is the scholarships, it's a yearly basis. Your scholarship gets renewed every year. So if Florida had wanted to, I'm just throwing this, you know, out there, if they were so pissed at Dan Warner because of how he performed, they easily could have pulled his scholarship and made him a walk-on.
Right.
And then given that scholarship to some top recruit that came in. It's a yearly basis. So
that's what I'm saying. Like, let's say a star, like a good athlete, goes through 4 years, you know, of eligibility, and then they, you know, they're not graduated because they don't get enough credits because they can't because they've got so much invested time-wise athletically. Then is their scholarship pulled technically after those 4 years of eligibility and they're left to pay their own way for the rest of their credits? Is that on the table? Because I could absolutely, like, I'd understand 100% then.
But then my only converse argument to that is they're forced to be here during the summer to take classes. Most athletes that are here for 4 years end up graduating, like, semester early. Right. Like, end up graduating, like, the fall of whatever their senior year is because they've been here every summer and through all that. My only contention with that argument is that how many, like, not that many players, you know, there is that stupid commercial, but not how many players that go to professional sports.
Right.
So.
But none of the student bodies go into professional sports either, is it? You know what I'm saying? Like, why are they held to a higher graduation standard than just UF in general?
Well, that would be interesting to see what UF's actual graduate, I mean, we threw out, you know, just kind of an obtuse number.
All right, but let's say,
60%.
Go on the high end. Let's say it's 75%, which to me is, like, really high end. I think there's probably no way that that's the actual number. But let's say that it's 75%. If you heard a coach is graduating 75% of his players, you'd be like, eh. Like, all right, that's not, like, shameful, but he's not, like, one of the higher end coaches. Right. You know, you're not, like, guy who's graduating 95% of your kids or something like that. So to me, I think there's a clear double standard. But, yeah, I mean, if we could do more research and get some hard numbers, and there might be a story there, but I just think it's...
Well, I think there should be a caveat to it, then. I think there should be a caveat if those... What, you know, you should... The coaches should graduate as many players as possible that don't go pro.
Right.
If you know, you have four players go pro, okay. But he graduated 95% of his players that didn't go pro.
But is it the coach's responsibility to make sure his kid graduates?
I mean, it's the program. It's the kids in the programs.
Exactly. It's the coach's job to make sure he's not playing him if the kid's doing something wrong. But you can be doing everything, you know, right relatively and not graduate. Right.
I mean, this is...
it's not the school's fault I didn't graduate in 4 years, you know? It's my fault, you know? So I don't understand why the coaches are held to, like, this weird standard.
Right, well, but I mean, that's part of the issue. It's just that
there's just
this double standard.
There's a lot of hypocrisy also, because, to be honest, the school doesn't care if you graduate in 4 years. If you go longer, they get more money, you know?
Exactly.
So there's just... To me, there's just a lot of hypocrisy in the situation.
And that's why the NCAA is going through this, you know, they want it. They want their cake and they want to eat it, too. They want to be this, you know, beacon of academic light, you know, of for all these great institutions. Yet they want these coaches to do whatever they can to win as much as they can and make as much as money. I mean, the other horrible thing is, why can't, if a kid doesn't like their program, the school that they're at, that, you know, they were influenced wrongly, you know, whatever way, and they ended up at one school and they decide not to go to another, and they then have to sit out a season. Yet a coach can jump from one thing in one school to take more money in another school and just leave those kids, you know, in the dust.
Right.
I mean, why do those kids have to sit out and the coach doesn't have to do that?
And we can transfer without sitting out.
Exactly.
Like, me and Adam and Jesse and Greg can go transfer. We don't like Florida. We're paying.
I'm considering it.
Yeah. Are you really?
No.
I hope not. Okay. Anyway, but we could transfer and, like,
exactly.
there's no penalty for transferring.
Right.
Like, we're all kids here. We all know kids who have jumped multiple times and it happened. Like, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Here's the thing for me, though. Comparing generic athlete graduation rate to generic student graduation rate, I feel like if a student doesn't graduate, just like non-athlete, then it's easy to just say, well, that's probably that person's fault. Either they were lazy or they didn't do what they had to do or they couldn't cut it. But when an athlete doesn't graduate, it's really easy to look at the amount of time that they had invested in the program and then pass the blame on to a coach or the program or the AD or whoever within there. So then I feel like to avoid that blame, they want to make sure those people are at a higher standard than the generic students so that there's no blame to be put anywhere, if you know what I'm trying to say.
And also those the athletes get a lot of, you know, benefits that other the generic student population doesn't get. I mean, they're obviously having to practice.
Yeah, but you're taking kids. Let's be honest here, and this isn't the case with all of the kids. And I'm speaking in generalization, so I'm sorry if this isn't 100% PC. But you're taking kids who don't belong at Florida ordinarily, or would never get into Florida. If you put me in Harvard or something, I'd have no chance. There's no way I belong at Harvard or a school like that. And I would need all those benefits for somebody essentially to just spoon feed me and get me through. But I'm not there because on my own merit, because that's a place where like I can hang and like really do well or like excel. Like I just feel like there's really just like a ton of hypocrisy in the system.
Right. So. Yeah. There's certainly no doubt that the NCAA is built on hypocrisy at this point. Like right. The whole
and
system itself.
I was talking to, you know, after we watched the HBO Real Sports, I was talking with Mike McCall and then one of our other friends who's in law school at Florida, and he was saying that, you know, we're talking about, like, what's the ideal system, what would we do? And my friend said, you know what, for college sports, honestly, what might be the best way is that these kids who are on these athletic teams and stuff, guess what? They don't even have to go to school to play for the athletic team. You sign them to contracts like you would anybody else. You decide how much money you have to devote towards that kind of stuff, and they play football for Florida without going to Florida. So they represent your school on the field, but not in any other way. They're not kids from your school. And that sounds radical, but at the same time, that's pretty much what's happening now. Like, the genesis of college sports, what it probably was I'm going to get my team of guys from my college, and we're going to play your team of guys from your college that already go there. And then somewhere along the way, it got warped into who can bring in the best players that wouldn't ordinarily be at your college anyway. So right. Are these guys really representative anyway of the student population?
I mean, I would say that is pretty radical. I prescribe to Jason Cole, who we've mentioned several times, pitched an idea to me and to other people before, and I've subscribed to that idea ever since, of this whole, basically it's a loan scheme. Not a scheme, makes it sound illegal, but it's a loan system. It's a loan idea, because the problem with paying, I mean, Title IX, you'll never be able to escape. If you have to pay Tim Tebow the same as you paid the 12th man on the women's basketball team. I mean, that's how Title IX works.
Right.
But if you set up some loan system where an independent agency assesses the value, your future value or your current value, Reggie Bush would have saved himself millions of dollars in legal fees if he had a loan, they could have been like, we will give you a $300,000 loan. You have to pay, you know, X amount, you know, over time and this, that. And all of a sudden, he, you know, saves himself all this money. Instead of he just got $300,000 and then it cost him $5 million, you know, in legal fees. So that's cool. I mean, it's a little more complicated than that, but I just, you know, tried to say it as fast as I could.
Right.
We're on a time crunch. But basically, that's what it is that it's a loan thing. So, like, the best women's basketball player, she may not get that much because there's not that much value in women's basketball.
Exactly.
But she could get some
something.
Money.
Yeah.
She could get something. And so, you know, Jeff Demps for track, he could go, you know. He may not have as much value on the football field, but he could go, you know, merit is worthwhile. He's got X amount of endorsements, you know, has the possibility, you know, what he can do in the Olympic trials, this, that, and the other. And so give him some money. And so it's a way to kind of get around Title IX, but still give these athletes that think they deserve and possibly so, you know, some extra money.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely better than the system we have in place right now. But at the same time, it's still kind of like you're still going to have boosters giving kids money to come to their school. And that's what kind of like this whole, like, you know, paying kids to just play for you and not go to your school thing, it kind of opens the door for, like, if a booster wants to give you money or whatever, they're allowed to. You're a professional at that point, you know? And I think we're kind of kidding ourselves at this point. This, like, ideal of amateurism, it's just not – it's never going to be, like, a clean thing or something that you can control. So.
Right. All right. And, unfortunately, we do have to wrap it up there. There's a lot to talk on, a lot to email us on, a lot of stuff that we're certainly going to come back to in future podcasts. This is a very – very interesting topic, very heated topic. People are really passionate about this stuff now for some reason. I think
it's
the documentaries.
Really
caught
on for some reason.
Like, so. We've been on radio at WRUF, a lot of calls about that. The documentaries that Kyle was talking about. For now, send any feedback to podcast@alligator.org. Get us at us on Twitter, twitter.com/alligatorsports, on Facebook. You can read all Kyle's stuff.
Okay, yeah. Let's clear this up. I don't know if anybody out there is wondering, but if you're not, you're going to get the spiel anyway. Gatorbait.net. was formerly the Rivals site. That was the URL for the Rivals Gators website. But Gatorbait was the name of a magazine who was teamed with the site. That magazine, the contract between the two parties expired at the end of March. Gator Bait is now with 24/7 Sports. They are no longer part of the Rivals Network. So they took with them the name, the URL, the magazine, their writers, Marty Cohen and Mike Hodge. The rival site, still well and good, still the same format, still the same writers for the site. And you, now the URL address is insidethegators.com. That's the only thing that's different. Everything else is the same. It's still part of the Rivals Network, still with Yahoo, still the same format. Everything else is good. So you can check out all our stuff on insidethegators.com.
All right, and we will be back next week. Thanks for listening.